Things are going to start happening to me now.
You've done all the reading. You're a scholar. You're a professor. You've done all the reading. You've done the intellectual heavy lifting.
Or less, eat shit and die.
You wouldn't know a fact if it begged you all night long.
Want to, like, give the wrong impression, because I am very high.
F***ing right up behind him with a hatchet. Smash, smash, smash.
Yeah. Care. I'm a libertarian. What I'm getting is,
did you vote for Joe Jorgensen or Trump?
Who?
Joe Jorgensen. That was the perfect answer. Thank you. That was...
We are continuing our slog through Tom Woods Week. Welcome, everybody. This is Tyler Yonke, the Libertarian Podcast Review. We're moving along. It's Tom. We're doing the 3x5 card of Jesus. This is really still happening. Yes, we're doing clips from episodes 381 to 1840. We're almost done, people. Although, Tom, you just keep flying along. You keep continuing to record shows. I'm not going to be able. I'm trying to catch up and get done and over with. I there was a guy in our group chat the other day. He started taking on and saying some things about Tom Woods. Just one when something, and it was completely incorrect. And so I said, as someone who's listened to 2,300 of his episodes, and this guy calls me out and he's like, you have not done any whatever. And then my buddy Andy happened to actually kick him out of the group chat. Not for that, but because other stuff, he was annoying. But yes, I've listened to almost, I don't know if I've, almost everyone. And so in some multiple times, because I'm, what am I doing here? We're reviewing the Tom Woods show. Great Tom Woods, and we're going to be playing some clips for Tom Woods. So here we go. I think we'll start right up here. What are we starting with? This is episode 1420. So I know it's the 1380 through 1840, and I picked the best ones that I think from that group. And with those in mind, we are going to start out here with 1420. It's the real anti-war movement. Takes all kinds. So Tom Woods writes this book with Murray Polner, and he brings him on, and they talk about this, who dare say no to war. Okay. Tom Woods, brings him on here and talks about it. And, so I thought we'd play some clips of that kind of in honor of Murray, cause he ended up dying not too long thereafter. So, without further ado, let's play, right up here in front. This is what's in the book. Can't say it. We who do dare say no to war, Murray Polner and Tom Woods, take it away.
We each selected, let's say, speeches, book excerpts, poems, anything you can imagine, articles that we thought were some of the best, most incisive anti-war writing for all these wars. And we assembled them. We wrote little introductions to them, providing context. And the result, I think, was pretty darn good. The contributors are all over the map. So Daniel Webster, John Randolph, John Quincy Adams, Charles Sumner, Julia Ward Howe, Lysander Spooner, Stephen Crane, William Graham Sumner, William Jennings Bryan, Robert La Follette, Randolph Bourne, Helen Keller, Jeanette Rankin, David Dellinger, Robert Taft, Murray Rothbard, Russell Kirk, George McGovern, Philip and Daniel Berrigan, Butler Schaefer, Country Joe and the Fish, Andrew Basevich, Pat Buchanan, Bill Kaufman, Paul Craig Roberts, Howard Zinn, and Lou Rockwell. Pretty diverse. Now, I suppose you have probably never read Samuel Taggart's speech against the War of 1812. Well, neither had we. But the arguments Taggart had to answer have an eerily familiar ring. So, for example, the Canadians are terribly oppressed, and they're going to jump for joy when their American liberators arrive. I mean, that's the kind of thing he was dealing with. And if they don't jump for joy when their American liberators arrive, then they're a race of debased poltroons who deserve whatever American forces choose to shell out to them, the usual stuff. Our book consists of 70 selections, along with Butler Schaefer's list of great anti-war films, and I know you'll enjoy that. William Goodell tells the truth about the Mexican War, and Alexander Campbell makes one of the most compelling Christian arguments against war I've ever read. Anti-war abolitionists like Ezra Haywood and Lysander Spooner also have their say, as does Clement Vallandigham. He was the Ohio congressman who was exiled for his peace advocacy during the Civil War. Jeanette Rankin was the first woman to serve in the U.S. House of Representatives, and she was the only person to vote against American entry into both world wars. And so we feature her defense of both of those votes. If you've never actually read Randolph Bourne before, we associate him with the phrase, war is the health of the state, then you're going to be blown away. And then more recently, we have a selection from Professor Andrew Bacevich, who writes about losing his son in the Iraq War, and that was a war he himself had opposed for years. This, by the way, is the kind of book you can innocently give to a left liberal friend.
Okay, so look, I'm just got to get through all the clips here. I'm giving you some senses of what's out there and maybe some highlighted, give you a little taste, a little catnip, so you want to actually go back and listen to some of these and ones that caught my fancy, as you might say. And I am very interested. I need to go actually get this book and take a look at it because there's multiple times. By the way, I would love to, I'm sure it's out there. I just haven't done a deep dive. I've done a peripheral thing, which is kind of like Murray Rothbard and some of the right anti-war people's take on the Vietnam War. That to me is this seminal thing. We've got to have all the hippies and the lefties that came out there. And I've said this before. I believe that in Tom Woods, I had a clip of him actually saying this, where the agitators and what they were more like was almost, it was more about their politics and their lefty stuff than being anti-war. So maybe the book has it. Maybe Tom, maybe you have that. Let's go to one section of the book because I thought it was interesting about conscientious objectors. I've kind of got a history of this with my own family. My grandfather, now he was in World War I, okay? And by the way, my dad was quite the accident, so he came along later. So we have this World War I, then my dad just missed Vietnam, Anyway, point is my grandpa actually served in World War I. He was a Seventh-day Adventist and he didn't want to work on Sabbath, and he had the Saturday and he had the time off for that. But he got court-martialed anyway. It was a mix-up. He got actually sent to Leavenworth. I've done a Substack thing about it. And then he was in Leavenworth. He spent some time there. Actually, he was supposed to be sentenced for, I think, 13 years, only spent 6 months. Comes out, dishonorable discharge. And President Ronald Reagan actually gave him an honorable discharge, a flag, all this, some hero stuff in the early 1980s. It was kind of a big deal for our family, at least to give my grandfather quite the and you know what? He never talked bad about his nation. He was always loving it, and he was treated like shit. So quite the man. And I did the little write-up. There's a newspaper thing, and I have his flag that he was buried in. So I thought that was interesting. Anyway, a little bit of and by Desmond Doss, by the way, also Seventh-day Adventist, and I met him. He came to my school, I think, when I was in high school. I'm old. So another person, conscientious objector from World War II. Let's take it away.
CO stands for conscientious objector. I mean, remember, we're dealing with a generation that doesn't know the draft, so they may not actually be familiar with this concept. Can you just take a minute to explain what the law was pertaining to conscientious objection?
Yeah, the last person, that poor sucker, poor guy was drafted June 30, 1973. And the conscientious objectors initially said, America's been pretty good, except in World War I. They were terrible to conscientious objectors. From 27 to 37 people were sentenced to death, though no one ever died. And they sent them to long prison terms and so forth. Americans go crazy periodically. Alien and sedition laws, red scares, McCarthyism, and all that horrible neo-fascist crap on me. But the conscientious objectors, America in World War II was better and generous, and in Vietnam, extremely generous, but the whole system was breaking down Selective Service. If originally it said that you had to have a religious orientation, had to be a Quaker, a traditional historical religious groups, Quakers, Mennonites, Amish, and so forth and so on. During the war, a guy, it must have been the ACLU people, they applied for, they objected to it. And therefore they added you had to have, not only you could have a religious objection or a very powerful ethical and moral objection to war. It couldn't be a particular war. It couldn't be a political instance. I don't like Bush, I don't like Obama, et cetera. It had to be that you came from a world or you moved into a world that couldn't ethically, morally, or religiously support a war. And large numbers, increasing numbers of volunteers who joined after 9/11 have been discharged because they have since come to believe, or they have come since to believe, that war was not the answer for them. Well, they did not speak of the justice or right of the unjust and crazy invasion of Iraq, but they spoke about their feelings. And in many cases, the Defense Department accepted it. But they learned that if you don't want to be in it, then let them go. They got this, they got honorable discharge. And so, incidentally, a cause that I'm trying to get into, the numbers of volunteers in those military got dishonorable discharges, often for very stupid, inane, trivial reasons. They're denied to this day, all the rights that a guy like me who had an honorable discharge gets.
Yeah, that's an interesting part. So just a kind of an interesting concept. I remember there was a guy, I think he was on Thaddeus Russell's podcast, Unregistered, and he talked about getting an honorable discharge, not on a religious basis. So that was that's kind of an interesting point there. Anyway, let's keep moving on. So I would, one, I enjoyed that whole thing. It made me interested in the book. I do need to get that book. Sorry, Tom, I haven't purchased it yet. Let's move along. This is episode 1424, Feminism in the Family. I'm always interested in these kind of things because I'm not interested in feminism necessarily. So I thought this would be the dearth of feminism. Take it away. I'm trying to remember the lady's name that was. Let's take a see if we have her here. We talk about Ladies of Liberty. This is Ladies of Liberty Week. Oh, Julia. Okay, let's go.
A lot of perfectly well-meaning young women out there who would describe themselves as feminists on the grounds that they believe that they should at least have opportunities to, you know, follow their dreams, let's say, to do what they want, to choose their occupation, to choose, well, obviously to choose a spouse, to make decisions, to be sovereign, in other words, not to have to get the permission of others. They want to be treated the way anybody, the way men would be treated. And they think this is just basic, simple justice, and that's what feminism is all about. So is that what feminism is all about? Is this a case of that was what it was all about, but then it's been betrayed? Or has there always been some baggage with feminism? Or are they thinking about it the wrong way? How do you respond to somebody who says, I'm a feminist because I just want equal opportunities?
Sure, you can have any kind of philosophy you want, and it can be as pure as, you know, the founder, the original women that coined the term or didn't coin the term, but had the skeletal outline of what feminism was and is not today. But what I'm saying is, you can have a philosophy and it can be pure in your mind and you can preach it. But I like to look at feminism today as the action, like what has happened? What are the results of this philosophy? What are we seeing? So, I mean, birth control is a big one, right? They equalize the playing field of reproduction in theory. But what is the result? You know, our mating market and sexual market is completely different now. It allows women to signal things that they couldn't before and do things that they couldn't before. And it puts men in a state of apathy. So for example, with the birth control pill, if a woman can not get pregnant and still have men have intercourse with her without, you know, condom, like they have the kind of intercourse you have in a marriage where you do things that result in children usually. And then you have the birth control pill, and it doesn't result in children. So basically, all of the incentive structures that nature had in place for human beings have been destroyed. And then that translates not only to, you know, a downfall in having children and, you know, also a downfall in having families, having relationships, having healthy bonding moments with other human beings. And a very interesting result of it for men is men become placated and lazy because they can get consequence-free sex all the time from a lot of women and not have to work for it. They don't need to have a big career. They can live with their mom. As long as they have a bit of game, they can go get laid. And this has created for society a very short-term mentality in terms of life. And for women, unfortunately, men can turn this around. Like men can keep having kids until like 45, even 60, I've heard 70, oh. Not preferable. But for women, it has very severe consequences that a lot of ladies figure out much later in life after they've done all the kind of feminist stuff of acting like a man. And then they're 35 and perhaps they're actually a very highly desirable woman on paper in most spheres of her life. But because she's 35 now, the man that realized that he should stop screwing around at 35 will go marry a 25-year-old and have a family with her. And the women are just kind of left behind. And it's a result of their own collective choices. And unfortunately, because so many women are making those choices together, the market becomes competitive for, you know, outdoing each other in sexual performance.
Ay, ay, ay. She's got some points. It's hard to argue some of that. I think that is I'm not going to get into it. And Tyler, you're going to make trouble. So let's keep going here. So feminism, raising a boy, that's always an interesting prospect.
Let me ask you specifically then, how old is the boy?
3 and a half.
Okay. In this kind of world that has all the flaws you've described, when he becomes an older man, let's say a preteen, teenager, how do you intend to raise him in the sense of what are you going to teach him about the way the world is and how he ought to fit into it?
I think with children, the best way to teach is to model, right? So, you know, if you really screwed up your life and your kid sees that, then maybe you might need to verbally teach them a little bit more about life. But if your life is intact, you find fulfillment day to day. They see you finding fulfillment day to day. They see that you have a good relationship with their father. They see their extended family. They have a good groundwork for morality, whether that comes from religion or just modeling good behavior that's based on a set of ethics that, for example, have always existed in America and the West. Then you don't really need to actively teach them that much. Children learn by observation. And actually, if you start teaching them the opposite of what you're doing, it could actually, you know, kids pick up on that and they'll just think you're, you know, a hypocrite. So the best thing I could do for him is to continue to model good behavior. And then hopefully he will see the results of that good behavior and want it for his own life. This is probably why Gen Z is like making a good comeback, because they've seen a lot of their older siblings and their, you know, Gen X parents and boomer parents screw up a lot. And they're rebelling against that kind of culture that their, you know, parents and grandparents have created.
You hope that's what the case is, right? Or maybe they're just coming to it on your, I don't know. Sometimes you have people, maybe that's what it is. I don't know. Anyway, the feminism thing, I think it was interesting. Next up, Tom here, and this is kind of he does this every once in a while. He has like an amazing guest. And I remember when this happened, you got Vince Vaughn coming in here, 1470, Vince Vaughn on Hollywood libertarianism and politics. I've got a few great little snips, from him. Is he a supporter of Ron Paul? How do you describe yourself politically? That's kind of the
question. How do you describe yourself politically?
Well, I guess I could describe myself more of a constitutionist, you know, a libertarian. I definitely believe in ethical principles and being consistent with them, you know, applying them both across the board, whether it's, you know, domestically or foreign.
Now, of course, I know that you supported Ron Paul, at least in the 2012 campaign. In fact, I saw you at his house once.
That's right.
How did that come about? Like, how did you get interested? Did you find out about him through the debates the way most other people did?
You know, I learned about Ron a little before that, and I was really blown away when I learned that the Federal Reserve originally was sort of my largest entry point, that it was private and that the government at large had no kind of oversight over it. And that really led me in historical, you know, learning about how, you know, first how the Fed was turned over and, you know, then FDR's confiscation of gold and Nixon taking us off the gold standard. And it was really mind-blowing to, you know, discover these things. And then I wonder, you know, the internet was so helpful, because otherwise you would have, you know, had to go to a library and research things and just time in the day. And then I saw that Ron was really the one that kind of awoke me to that. So I sort of started following him and listening to him. And then I reached out and called him and was just really sort of impressed by his way of speaking and all the things that he was talking about where that was concerned. And that was sort of the start of my journey. And I was thrilled when he was in the debate. You know, if you look at even the platform today, how much he really, you know, changed what the course of it was compared to when he was debating and they were asking him if that was, you know, what a conservative is. And now it feels like a lot of the things that he was saying that is sort of more of a mainstream conservative view, as it would be.
It'd be interesting to, I mean, what does Ron Paul think of Vince Vaughn calling it? I mean, does he know it is the Vince Vaughn? That's kind of the question you ask yourself there. But anyway, by the way, the Federal Reserve stuff is fascinating when you start to hear it, because you think you know things, right? And then you're not taught this in school the correct way. So that's fabulous. And it's also interesting that that's kind of what caught his eye. Because I think, you know, Dave Smith has talked about this too, how that could, that economics describes everything in a sense. So that is the essence of economics, invades every part of your life. And people that say that's not, they're not really thinking about it, or they don't understand economics. So that's fascinating. Unions. What do you say about unions?
There's another question that my folks were asking. If you have any opinions on unions in your industry, like the Screen Actors Guild, do you have any experience with those? And do you feel like they're helpful? Or what can you tell us about them?
Well, you know, I would err on the side that ultimately I think that the unions are probably not as constructive. You know, I do think you have a bunch of well-intended people. I think it's, you know, I think Friedman said, right, you have the do-gooders, and then you have the special interests, the people who stand to gain from that. So, you know, I think ultimately I'm not a union person. I don't know that the promises are actualized in a way that's constructive. And yet, you know, people feel very much so here that, and in a lot of industries, that the unions are actually sort of, you know, crusaders and sort of help them. I'm much more of a believer in free markets. And, you know, even where minimum wage or something is concerned, that, you know, I always find it interesting that politicians or people in the entertainment industry will have interns, and yet, you know, there's some price fixing of a wage where someone else who might be inexperienced or new to the workforce is not given the same ability to value the opportunity more than the price. So I feel that, you know, the unintended consequences and the casualties of it are usually greater than the outcome, not to mention the consolidation of, you know, power and who runs these things and, you know, what are done with these tensions. And there's just a lot of, you know, the media seems just a lot of time to stop when it comes to investigating those things.
On the question of Hacksaw Ridge, did that movie affect you in any way, like on war or conscientious objection?
It really did. You know, I found it interesting stuff.
Okay, so sorry, I was muted there.
But on the question of Hacksaw Ridge, did that movie affect?
Okay, so he said some things about the unions. That was good stuff. I'm glad to hear. You know, economics kind of invades everything. It's good to hear that he's kind of on board with that, especially with the. Union stuff. I don't know. Okay. So next one we're going to play here is Hacksaw Ridge. He was in that movie. Desmond Doss was a Seventh-day Adventist conscientious objector. We just talked about that in the previous thing. I'd met him in high school. So let's see what he had to say about being in that movie.
Do you in any way, like on war or conscientious objection?
It really did. You know, I found it an interesting subject. For a war movie, you know, here's a war movie with a person that was making a decision not to carry a gun. And I was unaware of Desmond Doss's life in the first read of that screenplay. But I found it very moving that he had these convictions and principles and a faith that was so strong that he would, you know, really feel that he had a calling to go and save people. And that the fact that he chose to save the enemy as well, but refused to kill, I just found to be really interesting. And that was an interesting film to make. Obviously, you know, Mel is a tremendous filmmaker, very bright guy. And I was just, you know, being exposed to that story and learning about him and sort of what he went through. I mean, the truth of his life was far greater than the Hollywood movie, which is not always the case. But that was one of many battles that he was involved in. He was in multiple theaters in World War II. And, you know, when he would go out at night to save people in the film, they have a friend go with him. But in actuality, nobody would. They were terrified to sneak around in the dark like that, and he was unarmed, and, you know, just looking for the people to save. So I think, you know, the story is, in this case, like it is definitely stranger than what we made up.
All right. Okay, let's go to the next one. Double Dog Dare You. So if you don't know, he's big buddies with forget the guy's name, but he was in Christmas Story, and that guy's done some Peter Billingsley. There you go. Just hit my head just like that. That's old age, but sometimes it comes through for you. Let's see what he says about him.
Approach where you have more success. Are there questions you ask them that get them thinking, or an elevator pitch that you make, or anything that seems to crack through more successfully?
You know, what's funny is Peter Billingsley, who works with me, and he was, you know, obviously he was in the movie Christmas Story. He was Rocky. He'll shoot your eye out. He is terrific at sort of staying non-emotional and really almost in a Socratic method way presenting questions. And he's very patient. And I've seen him do very well with it. I try similarly to, you know, talk about the principle at hand that's being discussed, you know, and make it less about other things. And as you well know, you know, there are some people that are just, these are very emotional subjects and they're not really open to a conversation. They're not necessarily looking to be rational.
Do you have any particular interest in the 2020 election cycle?
Well, I think you always pay attention to the elections and what's going on. I mean, there's been a lot of things happening lately. You know, this whole Epstein thing is bizarre. I'd be curious to hear what your take on that is.
I don't know what to think. I mean, I think it's interesting to see that this is one of these times when it's not just one side of the aisle that has the so-called conspiracy theory. Everybody thinks something fishy happened here because the numbers just don't add up. And people had predicted this. They said, look, keep an eye on this guy because obviously there's going to be huge pressure to have something done to him or for him to do this to himself. And then this still happens. And it so happens that the camera was malfunctioning. I mean, come on.
There's so many things to it that are crazy. And I think you're right. And I think that's part of the illusion that you just sort of be argued for a party or support a party. It's sort of divide and conquer, right? Like Caesar said, if you're outnumbered by the enemy, get them to fight each other. So
we haven't still gotten the whole thing about Epstein. So anyway, that's Vince Vaughn. Good interview. Tom does it there. Pull some things out of him. Obviously, he knew that he had it. talk to some famous people. So the good thing there. We're going to skip through a few of these ones. This next one, 1562, it is, excuse me, the anti-libertarian character assassination and how to smash them. This is Tom doing a solo show. I'm just going to play you a few, because by the way, he mostly has interviews, but every once in a while he's got to do this. And I love the fact of how he kind of tries to take on some of these people. So this part is about Max Effin Boot.
Libertarian socialists, in their frenzy to attack me, linked their readers to a review of my book by Max Boot. That's how deranged they are. That's how utterly unserious these people are about war. Because if you know Max Boot, he spent much of his career cheerleading every American intervention, being upset only that they didn't go far enough. He has a record of wreckage, destruction, and death, the likes of which you can hardly imagine. He's been as wrong can be, on everything he's talked about. He is a vile, despicable, horrible human being who also says that new immigrants, one of the ways they could accelerate their path to citizenship would be to enlist in the U.S. military. So even immigrants who supposedly are people that the libertarian left pretends to be so interested in, this guy wants to grind them up into the war machine. And they say, oh, let's cite his article against Woods. I mean, that's not normal, right? Would you agree with me that's not normal behavior? That you'd say, well, I'm sure there's a lot that can be said about Woods, but I think I'm going to leave the Max Boot article out of it, right? I mean, like, it's just how odd. Well, who would do that, right? So these people would never cite an article by me, never, even though I don't favor any of these interventions, and a lot more people would be alive. As a matter of fact, a lot more non-whites would be alive if Woods had been in charge rather than the neocons. They would never cite me, however, but they have no problem at all citing Max Boot. These people are unserious about war. And you know that even more because you look at, well, what is it that Max Boot has to say about my book that makes him so unhappy? Well, a big chunk of it is that I don't support Woodrow Wilson and his decision to involve the United States in World War I. Now, it's like I have to tell the libertarian socialists, the socialists were against World War I. That's what you're supposed to believe. Like, I have to explain to these people what their own positions are. So they cite an article against me that's unhappy that I didn't favor the U.S. getting into World War I. An actual socialist, Eugene V. Debs, languished in jail because he pointed that out at the time, that we should not favor this war.
There you go. So we shouldn't favor World War One. Very interesting portion there. Tom Woods taking on Max Boot and an article written about him. Okay. 1605, two hard cases, child abuse and the coronavirus. Bob Woods, you know, gentleman that had the Contra Costa, what is his name? Anyway, the Contras podcast with Tom Woods and the crews. Let's take it away.
They've never really heard about this.
First of all, I should introduce this one. How to protect kids without a state. Because he does go through some of these hard cases of the state not having the state involved and how you deal with them to kind of this one, COVID and children. Now, the problem here, and I'm going to talk about it here. Bob Murphy, a great guest. But if you're doing clips like this, he and Gene Epstein are very difficult because they go on. They can talk for 8-10 minutes. I don't have time to clip stuff out quite like that. So I'm trying to get stuff to and Bob will start us an answer. And this is, he wants to get from A to B. But in the meantime, he then says C and he goes down a deviant path and then diverted path here. And then he pops back in. So sometimes Tom asks him a question. You have to go through about 2 or 3 minutes. And then that's where he actually starts to answer it. So this one is how to protect kids without a state.
Stuff to realize the way that the state is horrible in all the other areas. And just because there's the EPA doesn't mean the government's really keeping the environment clean. Just because there's child protective services, don't fool yourself that that's actually keeping children safe and maybe they waste some money or something. No, it does not keep children safe. Okay, so, okay, in a free society, though, what would happen? So here, again, I'm going to appeal, Tom, to the fact that I think, I don't know if I explicitly said this, we talked about abortion in, I think, the first episode, but when you were saying, you know, what's an area of libertarian theory that needs to be developed more, I do think the libertarian legal treatment of children needs to be bolstered. So real quickly, I've always thought it has to do with, like, the legal angle or the principle that could expand this area has to do with your ability to give consent. So even an adult, if you're drunk and you know, on a bar napkin, just say, I give you my house in exchange for you buying me the next round of drinks, maybe a judge isn't going to uphold that because they're going to say, come on, you couldn't have been in your right mind when you signed that cocktail napkin. This isn't a valid contract. And so likewise, you know, little kids agreeing to go in the stranger's car for candy or something, I would say the kid doesn't really know what he's agreeing to. And so
by the way, that can be a voidable contract. Certain contract can be void, which is the actual contract themselves is not valid. That is typically when you're signing a contract with a minor. Doing it with an adult, it could be that the situation would be where they would almost have the ability to say, it's voidable. I could have, maybe I was scammed into this, but I'm okay with it, type of thing. So anyway,
you know, that should not be construed as a voluntary transaction, and who are we to intervene? So that's partly how I think the legal system would have like a sphere of protection around children. And then also in terms of, okay, well, what about neglect or something? It's tricky. And I do think that it's a bit of, incorrect. So I don't, Tom, you tell me if you know that. People a lot of times allege that Rothbard's position was, if you have a toddler sitting in the high chair and the parent is just staring at it and saying, hey, you're free to get up and leave and go get a job, but I'm not feeding you, that the kid can just sit there and starve and that's fine and a liberty, or not fine, but that's not illegal. Do you know, is that actually his position, or is that more of a caricature from his critics, or don't you know?
Well, the only place that it's covered is in the Ethics of Liberty.
Mm-hmm.
And there, I mean, in there, he takes the view, first of all, that a child has an absolute right to run away. Mm-hmm. So that's one thing. And how would that right be manifested? Well, by actually running away. That would indicate that he had become a self-owner mm-hmm. at that point. So now that's a separate question. But obviously, if you're in that kind of situation, you would have the right to run away. But then the question would be, can the parent have positive rights enjoined upon him? I don't think Rothbard thinks that's the case. Now, since that time, as you may well know, other people have come along. And I believe, now I don't remember if it's... Now, Ed Fazer takes the view that you could do it. He tried to argue it from a libertarian standpoint. But I think it may also be Kinsella. And then Jakub Wisniewski have written on ways that you can actually enforce that sort of thing. On the grounds that, and maybe I'm not remembering their argument completely, but it would be like if I was semi, you know, almost imprisoned in your home, the usual example is I'm up in your airplane.
Right.
You know, if I'm under your care and you've put me in that position, you can't then withhold from me the things I need to survive. For example, like withholding a floor by opening a trap door right. and making me fall out. You know, there are certain obligations that you incur on yourself when you put somebody else in a vulnerable position.
Yeah, so that's great. And that's what I was going to say, Tom, is that's the way I think it would be. So what I do want to stress is, I guess what I'm saying is all the stuff I've read about libertarian in terms of legal theory applying to children, and I haven't read the ones you're talking about, so maybe the ones that you're talking about, Tom, I would have read that and said, okay, finally someone's filling this gap. But it seemed, up till the ones I had read, they seemed a little ad hoc.
Okay, I'm not going to go. Look, this is a very tough. I do family law, and so the CPS, what he's talking about there, this is a tough, tough question, and that's why it's just two hard cases. I tell clients often, CPS, Child Protective Services, can destroy a family or can save children at times. It's questionable. I've seen them do both. Now I would say in Tom's case here and even in Bob, and then even back to Carrie Baldwin talking about, evictionism, as far as abortion with, Walter Block, there's things I think people are missing here, which is kind of the obligations of what I would say the invitor and an invitee, in a sense, or licensor, licensee. So you have a hotel, you're encouraging people to come, they're going to be there, or you're having an invited guest over to your house. You don't then get to encase them and imprison, false imprisonment. Right? It's you can't do that. There's obligations you have. You can't have a negligent facility where it's dangerous. You know, those are the types of things. So with kids, I think it's that where you know what you're doing when you're having kids. You're either adopting them or you're having them yourself. And so then you have obligations to those children in that sense. And you don't just get, I think Rothbard's wrong in the sense of just letting them go. You have, can you let someone go? Yes. But I mean, you're much more entwined with them as far as your obligations, especially in your house, and to not harm themselves or not have a harmful environment. Anyway, there's some of those. And I think on the evictionism thing, you can really get into that, which is you've brought someone into this house. You then have a 9-month lease. You can't just evict them. I mean, if you do, you have to give notice. They have to be a problem. And then we can talk about those kind of things. So I think that Walter Block actually has a problem with those. Okay, enough Tyler sharing that. Let's go to the next one. Non-state reaction to COVID-19 with Bob Woods. Bob Murphy, sorry, I said that again. By the way, this coming out here in 2022 or 2020. So right around the COVID time.
A shorter version of your argument.
Okay. So the first pass, obviously, if everything's privately owned in a Rothbardian type framework, property owners can set whatever rules they want. And again, I know that seems like, oh, that's just easy. Well, yeah, right. And that's also why Rothbardians at today's age, often making other libertarians uncomfortable, really stress that stuff and say, you know, there's no such thing as a freedom of movement, that if people own property, they can set whatever rules they want. So that clearly here, if, yeah, you got a mass outbreak of a virus or something and people are contagious, it's a good thing that there's not absolute freedom of movement, that that's not some principle of liberty, because then that means you're saying the free society could be susceptible to this. So yeah, all the, you know, the people that own the airports and the cruise lines and whatever, the roads, they could all set whatever checkpoints they wanted to regulate who's coming in and out. And that would be one obvious way, or the, you know, the border. If there's some country, like the people who, the countries that border China, could all shut down their borders with them and have, you know, really stringently enforced checkpoints to make sure people aren't bringing the virus in. That would all be perfectly acceptable legally in a totally free society, because every landowner can set whatever policies he or she wants. To get more esoteric, though, like what you could do, and maybe this is what you were alluding to. So in terms of my approach to like law enforcement and just trying to regulate antisocial behaviors, instead of doing the model of saying, okay, we have a law code and then someone goes and breaks it, and then we call our defense agencies to go grab the person, and then there's a ruling levied against them, and my insurance company compensates me for damage to me, and then maybe they go wring it out of the bad guy. I flip it the other way around and say, I think there's also something where people would have insurance on themselves, kind of analogous right now to your auto insurance, where your liability coverage, right? So if you're driving a car.
Okay, we'll let him go there. But I just want to say, I did an episode, one of my first early, maybe four or five episodes of this show, on Rothbard, Ethics of Liberty, which kind of, it's his portion where he's refuting Nozick in there on Anarchy State and Utopia. And he talked, there's the portion in there, one of the chapters where I thought would be Rothbard's take on COVID, okay, which is all about basically assumption of the risk and things you have to do. So I thought that one was pertinent, and that's kind of what we're looking at here, but I thought that was a kind of extension of to what Bob was saying. Okay, let's go to the next one here. Episode 1622, you want your grandma dead, said the hurt. So this is where we started getting into a lot of the COVID stuff, and it's been fascinating for me to go back and listen to Tom.
There's been a...
This is with Dave Smith, to listen to them, especially them two, when COVID's first happening, and to hear their takes on it, and to see where they are at the time when it's first happening, what they said about it, and then kind of what did happen with hindsight, and to take a look at it. This one is Many Perspectives, You Want Your Grandmother Dead, Dave Smith, Tom Woods.
A lot of craziness from all sides of people's perspectives of this whole pandemic and what's going on. And there's a lot of people, when you take a fairly nuanced, mature approach as you have, you end up kind of making everybody angry at you.
Everybody's angry. Yeah.
So the people who are like, what are you talking about? This virus is a hoax. I can't believe you're giving into the fear. I've been getting a little bit of that myself. Then people on the other side are like, you have to lock everything down and you can't even ask questions about, you know, destroying the economy or government overreach or things like that. Those are the other people on the other side. And it seems like I've only seen like a few people. And of course, you're one of the handful of reasonable people who are like, hey, this virus is very concerning. This is very real and something that should be taken seriously. Also, ensuring another Great Depression and instituting, you know, martial law or something approaching that is also not so great. So, I mean, that's from what I understand the framework that you're coming from. Why don't you tell me what do you think of this whole pandemic?
One of my favorite people on Twitter said, you're trying to look at the evidence as dispassionately as possible and trying to wrap your head around exactly what's going on, just honestly and with the facts in front of you. And Twitter has no idea how to respond to this.
Okay. Well, maybe Twitter does now, but exactly. So Many Perspectives. Good to see what those two guys are saying at that point. We'll keep going on with their cruising right through
here.
It's
ridiculous.
When this is 1622. Once again, your grandmother wants you dead. What about if it saves even one life? I've always hated this argument, and let's see what Tom says.
Julie says, if everything I'm doing saves one life, I'll be happy. Are you kidding me? If you don't mean it, then don't say that. But if that were the truth, no one could do anything. I mean, everything carries risks. Driving a car carries risks. But and I know every time I get in that car, I could get killed in it. But I'm not going to give up the car because there are worse things that could happen if I give up the car. But the idea that if there were one... I mean, we could get rid of all the pollution in the world. We could. We could get rid of every single bit of pollution, and we'd also get rid of 4 billion people. You know, so, but yeah, it's true. I could probably save a few people from lung cancer every year. That's true. So in other words, we do have to think about, I mean, all the time government makes decisions about balancing different factors. It's not like, oh, it's just these right wingers who think you should die for Wall Street. They're always trying to decide if we have this regulation, we save, you know, one person in a million at a cost of $58,000. Is that worth doing? Maybe.
And in law, we always talk about the balancing of the harm. So if you're going to try to get a restraining order, as an example, against some company for polluting or whatever, there's the balancing of the harms you have to do of, you know, one person's irreparably damaged if it doesn't happen. And you got to show those kind of things. I do those all the time with temporary restraining orders or motions that we have to do. So what is that? Why is someone going to be irreparably damaged or harmed if something doesn't happen? And that's the problem here, which is you got to weigh all those things out. Even to save one life, there's what bumpers, you know, speed limit 20 miles an hour. It's just not possible. We're not going to do that. Friedman famously had that episode with him on Donahue, where they were talking about, okay, so this car caused maybe so many deaths. He's like, you know, the motor companies do that. They actually calculate out how many deaths is going to be, what they think it's going to be, you know, with just whatever their structure or their car, how safe it is. And that's just part of the cost of doing business. And you have to, and if it's, the cost is too much, then you're not going to do it. So we always do these things. Once again, assumption of the risk, balancing of the harms, those kind of things. So Tom's completely right. And if it only save one life is a childish way go about it. This one is the economics of the shutdown. Tom Woods.
I'm going to have coming out this weekend, episode 1620. I've got two economists on talking about the economics of a massive shutdown, because other than wartime, I can't think of anything like this. And in wartime, it's not a shutdown as much as it is a diversion of resources into war production. But from the consumer point of view, it has the same effect. There are certain things that are not being produced anymore. And of course, during World War II, there were a variety of consumer goods nobody could pay at any price. They were not available. So in peacetime, though, I think this really is, in the modern world, has to be without precedent. So I thought, let's talk about the economics of this. And so just one point I want to make here was the first thing I asked them was, when they say we're going to shut down non-essential businesses, I think right away there's a central planning mentality at work there. Because how do they know what are non-essential businesses? Obviously, when they mean essential, they mean like absolutely essential to maintaining order. So the people need to be fed and there need to be police to crack their skulls if they get out of line, that sort of thing. But if you were to say, well, you're going to interfere then with the scientific research that would have to go on to find a cure for this thing, they'll say, oh, no, 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 we're going to exempt that because that would be an essential service. But you have to think back. Remember the Leonard Reed essay popularized by Milton Friedman, iPencil? If you were to just sit and superficially look at a pencil and say, all right, we just want the industries necessary to make this pencil to stay running, you'd say, all right, I guess we need wood, graphite, rubber, and some steel. Okay, we'll keep those running. But then you got to remember, yeah, but the guy who goes to chop the wood needs to use a saw. And the saw is made out of something. You know, and he needs to drive there. So he needs gasoline. So he needs that to be refined. So he needs rubber made. He needs rubber in his tires. He needs an air pump. He needs all the stuff that goes into it. I mean, you realize it's so integrated and interrelated that as soon as you start saying, well, this one's not essential, that one's not essential, you don't realize how much you're breaking down this interlocking lattice work that is the capital structure, that is the economy. You need air conditioning repair if you don't want the rooms in the hospital to be 150 degrees. Right. You need replacement parts you can barely even conceive of today.
And by the way, that's all that perfectly well said and prescient, because that's exactly what we had. Look, inflation rising because of costs of breakdown of the transportation lines, all these things, you know, toilet paper was a big deal to begin with. My wife just mentioned this the other day. She's like, you know, we listened to Tim Pool when this thing was first, this is when she first found him. And Tim was talking about a lot of the COVID stuff. He was one of the forefront of a lot of this, actually he and Glenn Beck, but they were talking about it for different, they're like, the people are going to freak out about this. There's going to be government involvement. You might need to go out and get supplies now. That was one thing that they did hear from both of them. And we did, we were really ahead of the game on getting toilet paper. I'll just say that. Last one we'll play here is Tom Woods, Dave Smith talking about interest rates. That one, right? There we go. And take it away, Tom.
Because one of your older videos has been like going viral on Facebook. I saw the other day about you talking about interest rates. I think this was, it must have been back from around 2008, like around, because you were talking, or maybe a couple years after, talking about that financial crash. But I thought you did a great job of explaining why 0% interest rates in a recession is actually the worst thing you can do for the economy. And of course, now we're back again, 0% interest rates, which I, you know, in my lifetime, I mean, I'm not that old. I know, like I always say that, I go like, I'm really young, but then I remember thinking how old I thought 36 was when I was 18. So to some of the younger listeners, okay, yeah, I get it. I am a father pushing 40. All right. So I guess I'm not that young, but I'm not old. And to you guys, I am, but to everyone else, I'm not. But I remember a time in my life where the idea of 0% interest rates were absurd. Like, of course, we're not going to have 0% interest rates. But now, once again, we're right back to that place. And once again, no end in sight. They're probably going to keep them here for a while. So what do you, how would you, you know, just explain it to the layman that why do you not want to have the Fed mark interest rates at 0%, even when there's this bad economy and we need to stimulate or something like that?
All right. Well, you know, the key thing would be, in probably the video you're talking about, I go through something called Austrian business cycle theory. I might not do that here just for the, but it's not that hard to follow. You know, I mean, it's the equivalent of thinking the economy can run. It's the equivalent of thinking that you can run your life entirely powered by energy drinks. You know, like, you know that it can give you a little pick me up, but you can't, obviously you need some real nourishment. Right. And eventually, if all you did was energy drinks, your body would catch up with that and you would just collapse and crash. And that's not a million miles removed from what happens when they do this. But I would say that the thing I want to keep my eye on in this particular situation has to do with something I asked Peter Schiff about on my show. Now, most of your listeners will know Peter Schiff. You've talked to Peter Schiff, yes, on Part of the Problem. But he was a guy who was, I mean, it's not just that he predicted the problems with the housing market. I mean, he predicted them to a T, precisely what was going to happen. And I had him on and I asked him, I think some of the arguments that people like you and I make about why we shouldn't have bailouts of particular firms or industries, these arguments kind of ring hollow today. Because normally what we say is we shouldn't bail out these firms because if we let them go bankrupt, this will be good because their resources, it's not like we're going to lose the firm entirely. If there's any value in what they're doing, their resources will just be bought up in bankruptcy proceedings by better managers, people who will manage those resources better, more in the service of what consumers want. And so this is on net a good thing. And this way we'll be able to take resources away from people who have been lousy managers of them. So this is a good thing.
Okay. Check that one out. That's Tom Woods with Dave Smith. And we're just moving along here, people. Okay. Are the left and right experiencing two different pandemics? Sorry.
Let's try and start.
Hang on, Tom. Not quite ready. So this is episode 1648. The left and right experience in two different pandemics with Jeff Deist. Why are COVID lockdowns political?
I have several theories as to why this would be. But when I pose the question, you see that it's a legitimate question. It's a real phenomenon. What's your gut reaction about it?
It's not just a real phenomenon. It's a stark phenomenon. People's perception of the COVID danger and people's reaction to the shutdown runs very neatly along partisan lines. That's red state, blue state, conservative, liberal, urban, rural. You know, all those familiar divides. And I think it's intensified by the fact that this happens to be an election year, a national election year. And I think it's doubly intensified by the fact that Trump is such a polarizing figure, especially on the left. I saw an email earlier today, Tom, where someone was writing, I can't wait to see Trump swept out of office and see his tears on election night. I can't wait to see right after the inauguration is over in January and Biden is installed, Trump will be led away in handcuffs and taken to jail. But, you know, even when those glorious moments come, we're still going to have Trump guilt for this email said centuries, not even decades, but centuries, just like the German people will have collective guilt forever and ever over Nazi atrocities of World War II. So if you have this perception of Donald Trump, you know, up until this COVID stuff, I don't think Trump was any more or less fascist or authoritarian than Obama. And frankly, I think George W. Bush was probably more fascist than Donald Trump. So the idea that he's an existential threat to America, that these other previous presidents were not, and that it differs from them in quality, not just quantity, I think is wrong. But nonetheless, there is a significant cohort of our population, maybe that's 20-30%, maybe even more, who believe that Donald Trump is something beyond the pale, an existential threat to America. People like Robert De Niro.
Okay, exactly. I love the comment, Dave Smith, with his his libertas, which is, I just don't hate Trump as much as the left wants me to. So, okay, we're going here. Burden of proof on lockdowners. I think this is such an attorney, which Jeff Deist is, such an attorney's way of thinking it, which is there's a burden of proof on one party or the other, and it is on the lockdowners.
From my perspective, the overwhelming burden of proof lies with the lockdowners. In other words, if you're going to come along and say, we have to shut down businesses, which we've never done in any pandemic in the past, we're going to confine and quarantine healthy people, not just sick people, but healthy people to their homes, again, unprecedented. And this is going to cause, in a matter of months, you know, a 25 or 35% drop in GDP. It's going to cause 40 million new unemployment claims. It's going to wipe out all the job creation, so-called, that's happened since the 2008 crisis, the last crisis. And it's going to potentially, at least, risk the Great Depression. Then, yeah, the burden of proof is on the people who, even if there's 50 or 100,000 deaths, to say, no, 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 this is justified because we can't have anyone dying. I mean, obviously, we all understand that the shutdown is going to cause lots and lots of deaths, lots and lots of illness, lots and lots of poverty, and not just in America, around the world. So that's where the burden of proof lies. So that's what is so, I guess, aggravating for me about the lockdowners is they're the ones who ought to be explaining, not those of us who think that this is an overreaction. And I think that's where this is coming down. This is the why it's so nakedly partisan, I think.
And Jeff has a great point. He has another section in there about the experts and the burden of proof and the value judgments that they are presenting. Okay, let's go on. Wait, is this the one here? That's 1648, 1021. I wasn't going to play it, so we'll skip it, and we'll go to the next one. This one is Jeff Dice talking about shutting the courts down, which is, think about it.
But, you know, beyond that, when you start to say courts aren't open, I mean, think about that for a second. Now, you and I might prefer a private sort of common law court system, but here we are, and you start to say, well, divorces are on hold, and business litigation disputes are on hold. Obviously, evictions and foreclosures are on hold. All this stuff's on hold. And if you start to think about that, I mean, imagine all the contracts out there where one party just says, well, I'm not going to live up to my expectations. I'm not going to pay what I said I was going to pay, or I'm not going to deliver the services I said I was going to deliver on this contract. And you say, well, wait a minute. You signed the contract. You have to do this. And if you don't do it, I'll sue you. And then they say, well, okay, go ahead and sue me, knowing that the courts are backed up 6 months. I mean, that basically, in effect, changes the terms of the contract itself because it alters the bargaining.
Right. And the problem I had, I mean, we did foreclosure defense during the pandemic, and they were a moratorium on that. It was very problematic. Also, when I do family law and they're not having the courts open, I think the right to contract used to be a fundamentally unenumerated right, fundamental right under the 14th and 9th. And, you know, they're anyway, the fundamental right given to the parties. And I think the contracts used to be a part of that, and they've kind of removed it. By the way, that's if you listen to Brian McClanahan, some of these others, Gutzman, Tom Woods here, the 14th Amendment, 9th Amendment, maybe suspect. Anyway, that's for a different day, which we will play clips of on our final day of Tom Woods week. Okay, we're cruising along here, and I thought we can't go any further without having to include
carried out, you know, the
police brutality. This is a 1664 on looting and police brutality with Eric July. He had to bring him on during the BLM riots and stuff. So here we go.
False, the protest is being carried out by outside agitators. Well, then why the need to tell me that if you just got done telling me that in some abstract sense, rioting is sort of honorable? Why are you so anxious then to tell me it's, well, this is being carried out by agent provocateurs? Well, pick one, it seems to me.
Right. Well, and I'm not willing to sit up here and think that that's like the only thing that like that has something to do with this. Like, even if you see like some guy breaking down windows that looks suspect at an AutoZone, you're not obligated to follow in his steps.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? Like, so that's a complete non-point. And again, that's just people wanting to deviate from actually criticizing the bad behavior. Now, I've always said that both are enemies of liberty as far as I'm concerned when it comes to this institution, when it comes to this cops, and when it comes to looters. Like, I'm not forced to choose between that false dichotomy of, well, if I say something against it, then I, on the other hand, adopt the other position. And that is, like, I defend cops or something like that. That's buffoonery. That doesn't even make sense. I can condemn both of them. That's not even to say that they're equal. I can condemn both of them, and I can think that both of them are enemies of liberty. And that's not a way to lash out. Under no other human affair, under any other engagement, will we ever accept that, okay, Tom, you punch me, and instead of me punching you back or defending myself from potentially you punching me again, I go blow up my neighbor's house. That doesn't have anything to do. What did I do? I didn't do anything. You didn't get punished for that. And this foolishness that we can't just directly address the aggressors is just doesn't make sense. Like I said, the people that had half of any sense were the folks that at least took it to the precincts, but that's not what happened. You had people destroying other people's businesses that had nothing to do with it. The wig shop, the local diner was not who had their knee on that man's neck or anything like that. So
Well, do you remember the old days of the war in Iraq, and people were saying, why is George W. Bush attacking Iraq, which had nothing to do with 9/11? And these same people are saying, well, I can understand why you might loot a Chanel store over police brutality. Look, it's the same principle.
Did Eric say wig shop? That's the part I got out of there. Okay, we're going to the last one. Black advancement and looting. Was there
it should have
tied to that?
Don't everybody that it's not about black advancement. When it comes to this looting, they're destroying the property and they're destroying the livelihoods of people that are black as well. And they're not making that. They don't care about any of that because they're being opportunistic, very bad people that are doing this. And they will continue to do it until they see some sort of consequences or feel that the consequence, the ultimate consequence, is something that might happen, which while I'm in the process of actively, you know, make sure my people get strapped and prepare themselves, because I don't see this any other way. But that situation with that man should tell you that these people will, it was not about that. Like this whole idea that somehow looting is just an act of expression, because that's nonsense. They never cared about that. Your business can be big or small. They will come get you. They will attack you. They will do all of that. And you'd be a fool not to treat it as such.
There was a lot of gaslighting during this time by the press, you know, the mostly peaceful protest, that kind of thing. Tom talked to Adam Curry and fascinated. He's been on there, I think, twice or so, but I thought this was, we'll start off here with the beginning to Adam's history with Tom. And it also gives you a reminder of how Tom Wood's show starts.
Episode 1693.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here, The Tom Wood Show.
Folks, by now you probably noticed that news about the virus is almost always fact-free hysteria these days. So you need my brand new free ebook, Your Facebook Friends Are Wrong About the Lockdown. Go pick it up at wrongaboutlockdown.com. Hi, everybody. Tom Woods here. Adam Curry is our guest today, and I couldn't be happier. Those of you who are in, let's say, my age cohort will certainly remember him as an MTV VJ beginning in the late 1980s. But since then, he's done quite a few interesting things, and in particular has been an absolute pioneer in podcasting, which may in fact be an understatement. We'll get into that a little bit later. And of course, he co-hosts No Agenda, which is a fantastic podcast that I know you'll want to check out. So I'm delighted to talk to him today. Adam, welcome to the show.
Hey, Tom, it's good to be here. Finally, I guess I've heard so many people say I should be on your show.
Wow. Well, I'm glad we made this work. Years ago, I was getting started with podcasting, and you and I on Twitter, you won't remember this, but we had a friendly interaction. Like, you were offering to help, and I thought, well, I'm not going to bother the godfather of podcasting, but I appreciated your, you know, the encouragement. So I want to talk about...
I do remember that, actually.
Oh, good.
I do remember that. Absolutely.
Well, I want to talk about...
And I find that endearing, right? And Curry, he's been on with Clint Russell and a few others, and I don't know. There's something about him that I just one I think is super smart, and then it's kind of cool to see him say some things like that. Okay, we're cruising along here. He says weird stories, CIA writing hits. Interesting. Let's keep going.
I don't know, just bizarre interviews or strange things that happened or surprises. I mean, you must have some.
Well, Tom, I've been trying to write my book for several years. I actually got pretty far. Talked to a publisher, saw the contract, saw the non-disparaging clause and the morality clause. I'm like, now I remember why I'm in podcasting. No, I'm not interested. So I do relate to a lot of these stories on No Agenda, on the podcast. I think one of the coolest things I ever went through, which is actually now kind of bubbled up a little bit in regards to the Scorpions' Winds of Change, as a podcast that was kind of looking into, was this song perhaps written by the CIA to help stimulate the fall of the Berlin Wall. In 1989, just before the wall, I'm sorry, before David Hasselhoff brought down the Berlin Wall, there was something called the Moscow Music Peace Festival, which was Doc McGee was a guy, he was a manager of Bon Jovi and Motley Crue, and his Learjet had been caught smuggling, I think, marijuana into Miami or something. And instead of going to jail, they turned it around and said, well, you should do a drug and alcohol free concert in Moscow, and, you know, the state will sponsor it. Obviously, this was a CIA operation, but I went along for the trip. So it was, you know, one plane, it was me, of course, and I had a small MTV crew. It was Bon Jovi, Motley Crue, Skid Row, Ozzy Osbourne, which was fantastic. Here's my story. So Ozzy was really out of it, and Sharon was really kind of a rotund, very homely-looking British housefrau at the time. She's changed. It's like she's half the woman she was at the time. And Ozzy is standing in the middle of the aisle near the lavatory, and he says, Sharon, I got the ball through. And someone was in there. And Sharon's like, oh, Ozzy. And he just pisses his pants right there. It was the oddest thing. And that was just, we hadn't even gotten to Moscow by then. So it's stories like that that are fun to tell to the grandchildren when I get them.
Yeah, no kidding. All right, look, that'll last me. That's all I needed was the Ozzy Osbourne.
That'll last longer than the pee that Ozzy couldn't hold in. Okay, we're cruising along here. What's the next one we have with Adam Curry? He talks about being the inventor of podcasting. Is he? And by the way, I do find this a fascinating story. And I think it's interesting also how I think he made millions probably on getting the domain name MTV. But here we go.
I've heard people say that you invented the podcast. Do you think that's too much? Or how would you describe your role in all this?
The terminology, of course, I love saying I invented podcasting because it makes it so simple. You don't have to go into the whole story. I don't think inventions ever really come from one person in general. And I certainly did not invent RSS. But what I saw was at the time around 2000, and I was by that time, I moved back to Europe. We didn't have really broadband, but we had something new. It was called Always On Internet. So you didn't have to dial up. This was a revolution. Your computer could stay on and you didn't have to kick your kids off the phone line or switch it to the fax line. Many people won't remember this, but it was a crazy time. But there was no experience. So if you wanted to play a video or a song, you know, you would click and then it would wait and it would maybe 10 minutes or 20 minutes. And then we had experiences like real audio and real video, which were really in postage size, just crap. However, I figured if you could delay the notification and, you know, so I want to watch a video and my computer somehow knows I want to watch a video or listen to a song, it would download that for me before I wanted it. And then it would say, oh, I've got something new for you. Click on it. You could have a full screen, great experience. So it was kind of like a time shift that I'd come up with. And I went to Dave Weiner in New York at the time, who had done RSS for blogs. And I said, why, you know, that, which is a publish subscribe mechanism. You publish a blog and you have a reader, which used to be the Google reader before they killed it. And you could subscribe and you could kind of read through it like an inbox, different ways to do it, but some as an inbox. I said, why don't we do that where if there's a big file attached to it, the receiving side downloads it. And until it's downloaded, doesn't tell you there's something new. And so it took me a while to convince him to do that, but he did. And for 2 years, maybe we were messing around with it because there was no application until I saw my first iPod. And I looked at this thing and I went, holy crap, that's not just a jukebox. That's a radio receiver. It even looks like an old AM transistor radio. And I came up with the concept of why don't I make a show, a radio show, and I have a little app. I built it in Apple script, which is proprietary to the Mac system, where you subscribe to a feed, and if the feed updates with a new show, it downloads it. At the time, downloads it to iTunes, puts it on your computer, syncs your iPod. We still had to do that. And then you pick it up in the morning, and your new radio shows are on there. That's all categorized, et cetera. So I set about doing this, and I did what I would consider the first podcast. We didn't have a name yet, the Daily Source Code. And the entire idea was, I'm not a software developer. I needed people to get enthusiastic to build these pod, we call them pod catchers, these apps that would bring it in. And so there was this continuous loop where I was just telling the developers, and we learned so many things about, you know, just how it seems so simple, but you can make a lot of mistakes. And unbeknownst to me, because I was pushing tons of bandwidth that I didn't really have, I was just putting it on my Mac drive. The guys at Apple had seen what was happening and they were following it, and they were just letting me have all their bandwidth and not even telling me about it, which made sense in, you know, later in 2004 when Steve Jobs called me and said, hey, can I meet with you? Which was probably the most cool meeting of all, outside of Quincy Jones, maybe. And he said, man, I'd really like to put podcasting into iTunes. Are you okay with that? And I went, yeah.
You got to be kidding me.
I said, here, I built this directory. Let me give it to you.
That's a fascinating start there. And I remember podcasts when they first came about, you know, podcatchers and all that stuff. You hook your computer up and you got to do it. Okay, 1698, the fact-free lockdown hysteria. This is kind of one that really, I don't know if this drove Tom over the lockdown stuff, but this video, I think it was this show. He had done a video. I think it was at Mises, and it got taken down, and it was huge. My sister, conservative, she found this one, and or maybe I think she found it rather than that. Anyway, she was then getting Tom Wood's newsletter, so he influenced her a lot during COVID. He was a sane voice, so I do appreciate that that my sister got on that train. Let's start with this one. Sources. At TomWoods.com, lockdown. Let's go here.
Some of the things I say might be a little bit different from what you hear in the news media. So you may want references. Some people watching on YouTube may say, I don't believe that guy. Why should I believe that schmuck? Where are his sources? So I'm going to have a page on my website with the sources for some of the things that I say where, that you might want some source backing up. So that page is not done yet. But by the time the video appears on YouTube,
Clay, make sure and delay this appropriately. I'll have that page up. I just started working on it today. And then it turns out Pete Quinones is visiting us from the Free Man Beyond the Wall podcast back there. And how am I supposed to get any work done when Pete's, you know, talking my ear off? So that will be done by the time, but it will be tomwoods.com/lockdown. And that's where you'll be able to find the resources. Now, if you try to go to that page now before.
Okay. Just giving you an idea. If you still want to, and you want to go check out the Tom Woods thing, you can go to tomwoods.com/lockdown. Okay, this is Gene Epstein's advice, like the 80-year-old parents. This was mine. My parents were similar, so here we go.
As recently as March 7th of 2020, which is like a lifetime ago, having lunch in New York City with our old friend Gene Epstein. And Gene just turned 75 at the end of 2019. He's a retired book review and economics editor at Barron's. And we were having a nice lunch together in New York, talking about upcoming travels. And saying, well, I don't know, with this virus, I don't know what's going to happen with the travels and should we still go on them or not? And his view was, you got to live your life, man. You know, you got to just live. I mean, yeah, the world's a riskier place now, but you got to live your life. And here he was. You know, he didn't shake our hands. He did the Japanese bow. He's married to a Japanese woman. They gave us the Japanese bow, which we were quite delighted to return. But his view was that, you know, look, you go live your life. And maybe I'll stay in my apartment, but you should go live. Why shouldn't you go live? And we all kind of felt like, yeah, you know, that's about the right approach. It never dawned on us at that point that these decisions would be taken out of our hands entirely. We really thought that we were going to assess the pros and cons and make a decision. It just never occurred to us that this would happen, that the world would be closed down. At one minute, they'd be telling you globalism is the best thing since sliced bread. And if you think otherwise, you're a xenophobe. But then the very next minute, if you say you want to see the world, you're a grandma murderer.
Right. So I'll just say about my parents, 80 years old. They did a lot of traveling during COVID. They probably got it a few times. They said, hey, we've lived our lives. We want to see our grandkids. We're not worried about all this, and God bless them. Plus they're healthy people. And you know, COVID more takes out the unhealthy a little bit more than the others. Cuomo, if it only saves one life, this is great.
No. It became, according to Andrew Cuomo, if it saves only one life, that was the new metric. If it saves only one life, if we save even one life with all these draconian measures, they will have been worthwhile. Now that's particularly gruesome and grotesque coming from Andrew Cuomo. It is rather an upside-down world that the guy who by far has the worst record on this, by far, is considered to be the great model and savior. And then all these hapless governors in other states where things have been at least manageable are viewed as like the devil. But Cuomo sends infected people into nursing homes, says that's not his fault, and everybody goes, well, you know, he's got a pretty good point, and that is just accepted. This is not normal. Like, we're surrounded by crazy people. We can't even have a conversation. Because if you try to have a conversation about this, you just want people to die. You know, so if you disagree with, this is typical, by the way, of course, all the time we have to deal with. If you have a different opinion on what the welfare policy should be, that's because you hate the poor. Or if you think, well, you know, private property might solve this problem a little bit better, that's because you hate the environment.
Right. So I would just say this has been the mantra of the left for years, which is, you know, if it only saves one life, it's kind of their way of manipulating you and trying to do that. Okay. Is this the one I want before we go on? I think so. I think we're going to just wait a second. I want to do this one. This is about the stats. So let me bring this one in here. Sorry, Tom. Statistics. Here we go.
In New York City, that was the hardest hit part of the United States. And we can speculate as to why it hit so hard. Obviously, that horrible nursing home policy is a big part of it. I think early on, they weren't really sure about the right treatments. And I remember seeing a YouTube video of a doctor saying the ventilators are making things worse.
Yes.
And people saying, oh, this is some crank doctor. You know, listen to the science, everybody. Listen to the science. And it turned out, oh, yeah. Yeah, the ventilators are really a problem. And so, no, Andrew Cuomo did not need 40,000 ventilators, which is, if I don't get 40,000 ventilators, it's going to be a giant graveyard over here. They got a small number of ventilators. They wound up giving some of them away to other states, it turns out. So it turned out that guy, that doctor on the YouTube video, was telling us the truth. So between the ages of 18 and 44, we've seen a rate of 11 deaths per 100,000 in New York City. For people 75 and older, the rate was 80 times that. And for people under age 18, their death rate per 100,000 was zero. But this 18 to 44 group, and by the way, I know this will come as a surprise to you, but I don't belong to that group, that 18 to 44. The policy is apparently to deprive them indefinitely of all the wonderful things we oldsters enjoyed as we grew up, even though they're at essentially no risk. And yet they did a study recently where they asked people like in their 20s, how scared are you? Or like of 1,000 of your friends, how many do you think will die of the virus? And they had wildly out of scale predictions. I mean, the answer is like almost zero. And you know, they thought it was going to be dozens of their friends would be dead. I mean, who can blame them? I mean, what, they're probably watching. I don't know why, or what generation is that? Z maybe? I don't know, why would they be watching the news? But some of them, I guess, are. I mean, why would they have this view? So it's not just that they're worried about their old relatives. A lot of them are really terrified of the likelihood of dying when they, according to everything we know, they have essentially no chance.
I did, you know, I live in California, and I did a bunch of, they would have the stats. So I would pull those up all the time. And you can see that there was just no fear of, you know, like they said, young kids weren't dying, and it was obvious. It was that older 80 plus type that would, and it's crazy to have those stats and readily available, and still a lot of crazy motherfuckers here in our state. Last one, the jelly bean example reminds me of comparing vax and not and to drunk driving, which was obvious another horrible
example. They would say, if you had a bowl of 100 jelly beans and you knew three of them were poisoned, would you take a handful of them? Now, there isn't a 3% death rate. It's extremely way lower than that. But the idea was supposed to be, you see how stupid it is to risk resuming your life when there's this chance of, you know, so the idea was the only rational response is not to take any jelly beans. And then in terms of the virus is just cowering in your house. So leave aside the gross exaggeration involved. The question really being asked is, would you reach in and take something if there was a chance it contained poison? But what they're leaving out is the real question is, what would I suffer if I didn't reach?
Right.
What if I just stand there and do nothing? Because they're suggesting that my only possible concern in my life is the virus. But I have other concerns, too. One of them is not spending months and possibly years living like a vegetable. And that's what happens if I don't reach in. In the analogy, my reaching into the bowl is the equivalent of returning to normal life and thereby taking a risk. And yes, I'm prepared to take that risk because I want to live a life that's worth living. If the jelly beans represent everything I've worked for my whole life, if they represent financial solvency, if they represent all my hopes, dreams, and aspirations, you better believe I'd grab that handful and eat them without the slightest hesitation.
That's the whole balance of the harms, or the assumption. You take the assumption of the risk of what you're doing, but the harms, what, maybe there's irreparable damage if you don't take that jelly bean. I mean, I've reacted that way myself one time. No, but seriously. So that could be part of the problem. Okay. Last one we're doing here is episode 1741, Harvard medical professor, Martin Kulldorff, lockdowns, not the answer. Take it away, Tom. This is on Only Concern is the Virus, and Can You Stop It?
Conceivable that you could suppress a virus, not just flatten the curve, but actually move on to full suppression if you had a long and tough enough lockdown?
If you had a very, very strict lockdown, then probably it's possible to suppress it. But as soon as you lift the lockdown, it will come back.
So even then, no matter how inhumane you are, you still will have to reckon with it at some point.
Yeah, because, I mean, the only alternative would be complete eradication, but that's not going to happen with COVID. There are only two diseases in world history that has been eradicated. One was smallpox, the other one was Rinderpest, and both were done with vaccines. So this is going to be endemic. It'll be with us for a long time, but right now we are in the pandemic phase, which is not so nice, it's terrible, but eventually it will be much milder, and most people are going to get it when they are young, as a child, and without any major consequences.
And by the way, these are important to kind of replay back to give yourself some memory as to what was being said, some of the science, what was being predicted, and how spot on one Tom Woods and his guests were, that were vilified, if not tried to be canceled. Remember, other diseases were eradicated with a vaccine, but COVID didn't do shit as far as the COVID vaccine really for these people. And it wasn't really a vaccine. So that's part of the other thing. Okay. The age is affected.
More than 1,000-fold difference in risk between the oldest and the youngest. So among the old people, this is much worse than annual flu. But among children, it's much milder than the annual influenza. So we really have to use that feature of the COVID to beat it. And what happens is, sooner or later, we're going to reach herd immunity. That's not a strategy. It's what every pandemic or epidemic will eventually lead to. Either through a vaccine or through natural immunity or a combination of the two. So we will eventually reach there. And the question is then, how do we minimize the deaths until we get there? Well, we do that by protecting the elderly. So we don't know what percent is needed for herd immunity. But among that percent, let's say it's 40%. If there are a lot of old people in that 40%, then we can have a lot of mortality, a lot of deaths, because they are much more higher mortality if they get infected. But if it's mostly young people in this 40%, then we can have very few deaths. So the key to minimize the mortality from COVID-19 is to protect, number one, is to protect the elderly in various ways. Some of them are easy to do and some of them are hard to do, but we have to do them if we want to minimize mortality. While we let younger people live fairly normal lives, they should still take general precautions like washing hands and making like shaking hands and so on. But we should let them live more or less normal lives.
That would have been great, but that didn't happen. Okay. The next one we're doing here is Tom's charts and fallacies, case fallacies. I'll get into some of that here. Tom Woods and Kohldorf.
Besides, whether we lock down or don't, no matter if I look at different graphs of different jurisdictions and I look at case counts, deaths, hospitalizations, and I try to pick out which are the ones that locked down, which ones locked down earliest, when did they stop locking down, when did they institute a mask mandate, did they institute a mask mandate, I can't tell the difference. It looks the same everywhere. Why is that?
So if we take Florida and New York City and Sweden, there is clearly a lot of immunity in the population, for sure. And that's what's driving down the hospitalizations and the mortality. Because in all these cases, well, in Florida, they kept it open. So it's not going down because more countermeasures are put in. So that leaves that it's going down because the immunity in the community is increasing. And the same with Sweden. It has been going down and it's very close to zero now. And it's been doing that at the same time as the country was relaxing the restrictions. So it's clear that it's because there's an increase in the immunity in the population. Now, the question is that immunity enough so that when you open up everything completely to normal, that you won't have another little bump? That is impossible to know. But for sure, there's a lot of immunity in Florida, in New York City, as well as in Sweden.
What numbers do you think we should be watching? There's been a lot of controversy about whether we should be tracking quote-unquote cases. And some people say that these case numbers can be enormous and sometimes inflated because of the PCR testing problem. It's another matter. Should we be looking at hospitalizations, deaths, percent positive rate? There are all these numbers being thrown at us. What are the ones we should look at most closely?
In terms of sort of the current situation, like current awareness, I think that hospitalizations and mortality are the key measures. And of course, they come a little bit after cases, but the problem with looking at cases is that it depends so much on testing. So if you increase testing, you're going to increase cases. If you decrease testing, you're going to decrease cases. So it's very sensitive to that. So therefore, I think hospitalization and death are the thing of interest.
I said this, you can just think about it sensibly. Like my own, I'm not tested every day. So, the one time I did get sick, and I did, I went and got tested specifically to see, because I wanted to make sure I had it, so that I can say that it wasn't any big F, it wasn't any BFD. And so I was part of that testing. I was in there. I was tested. I was positive, and it wasn't any big deal. But my point is I'm not tested every day. So if you're testing every person every day, then the statistics, you can say how things are increasing or decreasing. People aren't going and getting tested unless they're getting sick, and some aren't. Some are getting tested all the time, not on a daily basis. There's PCR tests are all over the board. So anyway, those are the kind of problems you had. Statistics run amok. Okay, last one we'll do here. We got two more left here. Two more. Dragging this out is more harmful. Martin Kohldorf.
I wonder, is there some less blunt instrument that we can use that would still allow them to have a little bit more human contact than a lot of them have had?
Yeah, so that's a very important issue and a very sad issue for many older people. And one thing is that the longer we drag this out, so the longer we sort of prevent younger people to get the disease and build up the herd immunity, which they can do with very minimal risk to themselves, the longer we drag that out, the longer the older people are going to have to self-isolate. And there's two problems with that. One is that's very difficult from a psychological and social perspective to do that for month after month after month. You can do it for 2 or 3 months maybe, or a little longer, but to do it for a whole year or more, that's brutal. And the other thing is, it's harder to protect the older people if you drag it on, because they need to go to the dentist or so on at some point. So the longer you sort of drag this out, the harder it will be to protect the elderly and for them to protect themselves. So that's one point. The other thing is that I think there are some ways to do it so that it is less severe in terms of a social impact. For example, to do more frequent testing of nursing home staff and visitors, that would actually allow more visits to the nursing home. So that's something that both protects them and allows them to have more social life and social visitors.
Fascinating. Okay, last clip we're doing here of Tom Woods Week, this day, and then we got one more day.
Public policy then?
Hang on, Martin. Any public policy you would favor? That's the question Tom's going to pose to him, which I think is a fabulous one, a good one.
If you don't favor lockdowns, Do you favor any type of invasive public policy to try to slow or stop this?
Well, I think the collateral damage done by the lockdown is huge, but a lot of it is not short-term, but long-term. For example, the cancer screenings has gone down, and the diagnosis, the number of cancer diagnoses that we have are down, and it's not because people don't get cancer anymore, it's because they're not detected, because less screening and less primary care. So that's a huge concern, but those are not things that we're going to see in the tallies of the mortality right now, because it's not that you're going to die this year because you don't get the cancer screening. Instead, you will maybe die 3 or 4 years from now instead of 10 to 20 years from now. And there are similar thing with cardiovascular diseases. The childhood immunizations has plummeted. So that's the concern, because maybe we will have outbreaks of childhood diseases now. And there's more house evictions, and house evictions are not good for public health, in addition to all the other bad things they have with them. So the collateral damage is big, and it obviously hurts the working class the most, because they already have a worse public health situation. So it's that's a big concern of mine, and should be a concern for everybody.
So what would you have done differently?
Well, I think if we had done the age-specific approach, then we would not have had this big collateral damages anymore, and we would have been able to go back to normal life more quickly. So there would have been some interruptions, especially among the elderly, but there wouldn't have to be any interruptions about childhood immunizations, for example, because children should still go to the doctors as normally. And people shouldn't be afraid to go to the hospitals if they feel sick in any way.
See, and I think Robbie Bernstein has talked about this, about the selfishness of that older age group. That think about Joe Biden, my grandparents, my parents, they're not my grandparents, my parents, but then my parents aren't selfish. They're just not those kind of people. But there's a lot of them that are, and some of that whole of hippie generation that's growing older as well. And so if I'm not, they're the ones that want to control your lives as well. And if they aren't going to be able to go out, you shouldn't be able to go out. You got to save my life by not having this stuff. So it's horrible. That's not the way it is. Okay. Tom Woods week. We're almost done, people. One more. Next time, 1840 through 2300, plus a few, because I've got a few other extras ones to go in there. So there you go. Thanks, everybody. Like, subscribe to this show, and hang on. We got one more left. Thanks. Bye.
Okay, I'm leaving now. Bye, guys.
But she's back.
And now. Chick-fil-A is completely overrated. It's not that good. I prefer Zaxby's. I prefer Popeye's.
Takes a tough man to make a tender forecast, Nick. I guess that's me. Keep fucking that chicken.
Should I vote for Dick Cheney on the Libertarian Party? Do I have an obligation to vote for Dick Cheney?
I would say so.
Yes.
Did it work for those people?
No, it never does. I mean, these people somehow delude themselves into thinking it might, but it might work for us.
That one dude was like, not a podcast. I can't find it anywhere. They don't have video.
Oh, yeah. Peter Janky. Yeah.
Yeah, I blocked him.
I'll do it. If he unblocks me,
he'll buy your shirt if you unblock him, Bert.
He's a wigger.
Yeah, nothing cooler than so a 49-year-old wigger. Like, I just started live streaming. Cut me some slack. I'm pretty high tech for a boomer. But anyways,
for a boomer.